So for everybody who's already signed on, for all of those people who had been arguing for years that we should go to a platform where we could see people and not just have it be the phone, you were right, I was wrong, and you know, thank you for pushing on that, and we could have probably done it sooner, but thank you and Ricky Bradley for making the transition for the whole organization. We've been doing our group leader calls, but this is the first time where we're doing the national call by Zoom, where we can actually see the speaker, and there's times where we'll be able to see slides and things like that, so that's very exciting. A couple of seconds to go, because we will start exactly when the clock ticks over, which is momentarily. Hold on, can't start a second early. Start exactly on the second. Okay, great. Well, it's 1 o'clock in the East, noon Central, 11 Pacific, 10 on the West Coast, and all the other time zones you're calling in from Sweden and Alaska and Hawaii and Africa. Welcome at whatever time it is there. Welcome. So great that you could be on the call at this time. I particularly want to welcome the new chapters that started since last month's call. So that includes Fort Worth, Texas, Florida Space Coast. I hope you're safe down there. Capital Region, New York, Galveston, Texas, Dayton, Ohio, Ogden, Utah, Dallas, Central, Texas, Houston, Southeast, Texas, Chadron, I apologize, Nebraska, if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, Houston, Southwest, Sugarland, and Annapolis, Maryland. So welcome to all those brand new chapters. It is really, really great to have you. Ricky posted in the chat section if you have any technical issues, how to reach technical support. There may be time for Q&A today, we'll see. And if you type questions in the Q&A when we get there, please don't answer those someone else. We like to have that available for the speaker, and Ricky will let us know if there's any questions that we have. And that's just gonna depend completely on time. Oopsies. So our speaker, George Lakoff, is a linguistics expert and is the author of Don't Think of an Elephant and the Political Mind. After the 1994 election, he realized that the liberal conservative split in the US was due to inconsistent worldviews, but not generally understood. He realized that this was a problem for cognitive science and set about studying it using what he learned from cognitive linguistics, neuroscience, and neural computer research. So I'm gonna turn the call over to him in just a moment. George, here's the thing I want you to know about the people you're gonna be speaking with. You will never talk to a group of people that is taking more action to do something about global warming than the people on this call. These people, they'll do something last month and they'll do something this month. So let me just spotlight a couple of quick areas. This year alone, they've had 943 meetings with members of Congress and their staff, this year alone.
All right.
113 MPs in Canada, and 100 of those were face-to-face with a member. In terms of letters to the editor and op-eds this year, 2,187 published so far this year alone. They added 397 endorsements of either businesses or influencers in their community, because we believe our job is to build up enough support for legislation to get passed in every single community. And they also added 18,246 people to their chapters. So they are out busy making things happen. We asked Mr. Lakoff to start in a couple of areas, and then we'll see if there's time for questions. You know, either way, we're just ecstatic you're on the call. One thing that we asked him to address is direct versus indirect causation. And there's certain worldviews that have someone like Donald Trump make sense to them. And while for people who he doesn't make sense at all. But there's a certain worldview where what he's doing makes sense to them. So we asked him to start there, and then we'll see how time goes, if we have time for question. But boy, George Lakoff, we've been so excited for so long to have you, and thank you for making yourself available this particular Saturday.
First, I'm honored to have such an amazing group of people to talk to, and overwhelmed by all that you've all collectively accomplished. That is great, and thank you for asking me. Let me begin with systemic versus direct causation. This is something you find out when you're a linguist. Direct causation is very simple. You know, you pick up a glass of water. There's a glass, doesn't have water in it anymore, because I drank it. You drink it, it's no longer in the glass, it's in me. Cool. Direct causation. It happens here, it happens now, there's a change right here. That is direct causation. Every language in the whole world can express direct causation in its grammar. We all have grammatical means to express it. And no language in the world has a way to express what I'll call systemic causation. What's systemic causation? Take the case of the Republican senators who would go out and make snowballs in Washington in the winter and say, what do you mean about global warming? It's snowing here, more snow than we've ever seen before. And the answer to that is quite simple if you know how an environmental system works. Over the Pacific Ocean, you have lots of evaporation. What is evaporation? Water molecules that are charged with a lot of energy go into the air. Then they're blown by trade winds. They go north, east, over the pole. In the winter, when it's dark and cold there, the water molecules turn to snow, comes down over the East Coast, more snow in Washington than you've ever seen. That is one example of systemic causation, and it is a chain of causes. So one kind is just a chain of causes. There's another which has to do with interacting causes, cases where two chains of causes come together, and this happened with Hurricane Sandy, where you had a hurricane forming off of the coast of Africa, interacting with the winds blowing over the pole or below the pole. And what you had was two things coming together, causing a huge hurricane that hit New York. That is another form of systemic causation. That is, the system is causing something. The third is feedback loops. And you're all familiar with this. The polar ice cap is supposed to reflect heat and light from the sun. As the Earth warms, the polar ice cap starts to melt. The more it melts, the less heat and light get reflected. The more the Earth gets heated, the more it melts, etc. You have a positive feedback loop. Positive feedback loops and other negative feedback loops are all over. They're part of systemic causation. And finally, there's probabilistic causation. I remember a scientist being asked, who was a very good climate scientist, being asked at a meeting after Hurricane Katrina hit in Louisiana, and he was asked, was Hurricane Katrina caused by global warming? And he said, oh no, we can't say that any particular hurricane is caused by global warming. There's probability, there's this, there's that. No, we can't say anything like that. But the fact is, probabilistically, a certain number of hurricanes are going to blow from the Gulf of Mexico to Louisiana. There's a relatively high probability of that. And that is part of the systemic properties of the environment, namely probabilistic causation. What you wind up getting is combinations of all of these together. Those are the four parts: chains of causation, interacting causes, feedback loops, and probabilistic causes, and they come together. Now, that is very important to understand. We now have a major hurricane hitting the East Coast and devastating Haiti and so on. And I couldn't find any news report on this that mentioned global warming at all. Nothing. And it's very important to understand that people need to know about systemic causation. And not only that, the scientists themselves need to know that the notion cause is not just about direct causation, but systemic causation. And it's very important, every language in the world has direct causation, but not systemic causation in its grammar. And there's a reason. Mm. The reason is really simple. Languages are learned by kids. they're not going to learn systemic causation. It's just simple as can be. You don't need to be a linguist to think about that, but there it is. So, systemic causation has to be learned. It has to be taught, and it has to be named. And among the people who need to learn it most are the climate scientists. Mm. The climate scientists need to, who know all this stuff. It's not like they don't know it. They're the people who figure it out. Mm-hmm. But they don't know the language part of it, the part that, that what they're discovering in terms of all the things that led up to a particular storm, you know, are part of a system that has causal properties. And that is crucial. Everybody needs to be talking about systemic causation and what that system is. And we need to be able to talk to the climate scientists to tell us what they already know, but name it, name what they know. So that's very, very simple, straightforward thing, but it is incredibly important because most people, you know, just experience the weather. They turn on their TV, there is the horrific floods, the horrific deaths in Haiti, et cetera, from this thing. No discussion of global warming, whatever, mm-hmm. nothing. And it needs to be said, it needs to be out there. And the scientific evidence needs to be presented in a form that human beings can understand. And that's the next thing. You need to be able to understand it. I read one account of this that was so technical that, you know, I had to look up almost every other word. Mm. That's fine, technical things are good. But once you understand the technical stuff, you need to be able to explain it to people when the planet is being threatened. So this is extremely important. One needs to do that kind of work. And with this many people around the world, one would think that that could be done. And that's wonderful. You can all do this and start to do it now. Now, and if there are any climate scientists aboard, great. Love to talk to you afterwards when we start to talking. Now, if you're mystified by Donald Trump, don't be. What I'm going to tell you is already online. I have a website, georgelakoff.com. Go there, hit the blog, and you'll see three papers. One, Understanding Trump, Understanding Trump's Use of Language, and Understanding Trump's Name. And the name is important, too. We'll get to the name. But the main thing is this. It's not just Trump. There's a part of Trump that has to do simply with what conservatism is really about. And conservatism is a worldview that is not like progressive worldviews. I want to say a little bit about worldviews in general before we get to the details. Every idea that we have is not floating in air. Ideas don't float in air. Ideas are carried out by neural circuits. I'm finishing up a book on the neural mind right now. I've been working on it, on the details of how converging evidence has come together for over two decades to show how this works. And we know a lot about how it works. Not everything by any means, but a lot. And the first thing is that if you have an idea or a collection of ideas, there's a neural circuit in your brain carrying it out. And if it's an idea that's fixed, that you use all the time, then that circuit is fixed. It's going to be there, you know, unless there's a brain injury or some other thing. It's mainly going to be there. Now, and ideas get strengthened. The more you use language to express an idea, the stronger that idea gets. So that's part one. Part two is that when you have conflicting worldviews, those worldviews are in conflicting circuits. And the question you have is it possible for people to have more than one worldview at once? The answer is yes. And it has to do with the concept of a moderate. The thing about moderates is that they, you know, there's no ideology of the moderate. There's no thing that all moderates are. If you're a moderate conservative, you're progressive in some ways. Different for different people, but on some issues. If you're a moderate progressive, you're conservative in some ways on some issues. In order to be progressive or conservative on any issue, you have to have the right worldview for that. That worldview has to express that issue. So that means you have to have circuitry in your head that characterizes opposite worldviews that cannot be held together, right? How does that work in the same brain? The answer is very simple from basic neuroscience. It's called mutual inhibition and it's all over your brain. Every time you have a motor program carried out in your brain, there are inconsistent motor programs. I can't both take a drink like this and scratch my head with the same hand at the same time. Mm-hmm. That's mutual inhibition. The same thing with ideas. The more one is more ideology is strengthened in your brain, the weaker the opposing one gets. Mm. And that's an important thing. And Republicans have taken advantage of this for the past two decades. Mm. And we can talk about the details of how they've done that. But the idea is this: language for any particular idea, when you use that language, it strengthens the circuitry for that idea. Mm. Now, the next thing to understand is that all politics is moral. Politics is about morality. Mm. And it's easy to see. Look, somebody comes in and says, do this. I have this position. Here's something that you should do, and you should vote for this, or have your congressman vote for this. Okay, the assumption is it's right, not wrong. Nobody says, this is evil, but do it. Mm. You know, you want to be with the devil? Okay, I say do it. We'll all be with the devil. Nobody says that. Nobody says it doesn't matter. Mm. You know, just do it. It doesn't matter. You know, it's how to be right. And if you have opposite positions, you have opposite moralities. Mm. That's what's happening with progressives and conservatives. They're opposite moralities. And some people have both at the same time. That is, those are the moderates. They have both of those simultaneously. And that's a very important thing to remember, that they're there and that happens. So the next thing to understand is that you can only understand what your brain allows you to understand. Mm-hmm. Not surprising. Mm-hmm. You have certain brain circuitry and it'll understand certain things. And if you have one or another worldview, and those worldviews, you know, shut out other worldviews, then you will not understand certain facts. That's very important. You don't hear conservatives going around saying, I'm going to deny science. Mm-hmm. They never say, I'm going to deny science. They say, this doesn't make sense, or it's false, or whatever. And what happens is that if facts come in that don't fit your worldview, what happens? You can be puzzled. You can not notice them. You can ignore them. You can, say they're false, or you can attack them if they're threatening, right? And all of those happen in politics, right? Because you can only understand what your brain allows you to understand, right? So this is important to see. It's not like there are just these evil people all over the world denying global warming. It's that it doesn't make sense in a certain worldview. And we'll get to why that doesn't make sense. But it's really important to get past that. It's not like if you just tell them more facts, they'll get it, right? Now, we need to understand a little bit more about a moral worldview. Do you want to think that you're a good person?
Yes.
Most people want to think they're good people, right? Yeah, yeah. They don't say, look, I'm a real nasty guy. You know, I'm mean, I'm cruel, I'll be as mean as I can. People think they're basically good people, right? Mm-hmm. What that means is that their moral worldview defines who they are as deep as can be. Attacking that moral worldview attacks them as people. Mm. It attacks their very being. Mm. Right? Very important. Now, if you have people, lots of them, millions, who have opposite moral worldviews, you're going to have the situation we have now in this country with this divide. So that is what's going on here. You have people who feel very deeply about it. Now, if you have a moral worldview that makes you a moral person, it has a higher truth than any fact. Mm. That means the facts have got to be wrong if they make you a bad person, mm. right? And what is lying? Lying is about facts. Mm. So people can ignore lies and ignore facts unless they have a worldview that says, I really have to listen to facts. You have to, you know, there are people who views who say, look, I really care about science more than anything else, and I am going to listen to facts. And probably many of you out there are like that. But that is part of the morality that you have. If you don't have that in your morality, not going to happen. Okay? So that is crucial in all of this. So given all of that, what are the details? The details go like this. And let me tell you how I got into it. Back in 1994, when the Republicans took over Congress, I, out of civic duty, went down to my bookstore and bought a copy of The Contract with America, written by Frank Luntz. And in there, he said, this is for Republican candidates. If you elect me, I will get rid of abortion. And not only that, I will make sure there's a flat tax. And I said to myself, what does the flat tax have to do with abortion? And then he said, we will get rid of all environmental regulations. Oh, what does that have to do with the flat tax and abortion? And we can make sure that you can own guns. Wait a minute. You know, what does that have to do with it? And he went on for 10 of these things, right? You know what they are. So I said to myself, look, I'm against all of them. What do each of my positions have to do with each other? Ever thought about that? Right? It's not obvious. I couldn't figure it out right away, but I knew one thing. This was a problem in my field, cognitive science. It's a, you know, it's a cognitive science question. So I said, okay, I'm going to study it. I went and I did field work. I, you know, did all sorts of things. And at one point I went through the question, why is it that conservatives always talk about family values and what are those values? Okay. And I realized at that point that one of my students had written a homework problem where she showed that we have a general metaphor that we all use unconsciously, automatically in our brain. We think metaphorically. By the way, in case you don't know it, before I go on, 98% of thought is unconscious.
Yeah.
I mean, it's carried out by neural circuitry. You don't have conscious access to your circuitry. Most thought is unconscious. So she pointed out, hey, look, we have founding fathers. We send our sons and daughters to war. We have homeland security. We don't want missiles in our backyard, et cetera. You know, we understand the nation as a family. So I said, look, if you have two different understandings of the nation, maybe there are two different understandings of families. So being a metaphor analyst, I worked backwards and found two views of the family that were opposites. The strict father family for conservatives and the nurturing parent family for progressives. And it's a very interesting phenomenon to see this. The way the nurturing parent family works is this, and let's start out there. It starts out with if you have two parents, then they have equal responsibility for raising their kids. And their job is to empathize with their kids, to know what those kids need, to understand the needs of their children. And that requires two-way communication. The kids got to ask the questions or, you know, say, why are you telling me to do this? You know, don't run into the street. Why not? You'll get run over. I don't want you run over.
Yeah.
Why can't I turn on the stove and put my hand on it? You'll get burned. And I don't want you to get burned, and you don't want to get burned. Okay.
Right.
You know, you need to be able to explain why you say do this or don't do that. And you need to tell them what that is. That is part of being a nurturing parent. It's part of caring about it. And you want to make sure that kids get fulfilled in life and that you are fulfilled in life. You know, you don't want to be, somebody who's sorry about yourself all the time. You want to be as fulfilled as you reasonably can be under the circumstances, and we all have different circumstances. But you want your children to be fulfilled, and that means you want them to be healthy, you want them to be educated, you want them to have positive experiences of all kinds, to understand what possibilities are in life, and so on. Right? And not only that, you want your children to feel that way about other people. To not only be able to take care of themselves, but to be able to care about others, right? That's nurturing parenting, straight out, you know, all over. I suspect Those watching here know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Apply that to politics. It goes back to the beginning of this country. The idea there was citizens care about other citizens, work through the government to provide public resources for everybody. And from the beginning, that's how this country was set up. And it started with business. That is, you have roads and bridges, both for individuals to go back and forth, but for businesses to send their goods and get their supplies. You had public education, so people could have educated workers. You had, public hospitals. You had patent office for businesses. You had interstate commerce laws for businesses. You had a judicial system, 90% for business. You had a national bank for business, right? From the very beginning of this country. And this has just added on more and more as time has gone on. That is, business requires public resources. You know, think about trying to run a business if there were no sewers. Just something like sewers, right? You need it. You need an electric grid. You need all of these things. Now, in addition to that, you need scientific resources and technical resources. I'm old enough to have remembered when the father of artificial intelligence, Marvin Minsky, was a new assistant professor at MIT, where I went to school. And how is he supported? National Science Foundation. Computer science wouldn't exist without the National Science Foundation giving support to that idea. What about the internet? Is the ARPANET coming from the Defense Department? What about satellite communication? NASA and NOAA providing satellite communication. What about GPS systems and cell phones? I bet you don't know about this. It turns out...
George, can I interrupt you for 1 second?
Yeah.
We're going to hit a hard deadline at the bottom of the hour where we have to move on.
Okay.
Could you get
That's
on
a lot. Basically, we require all of that stuff. Now, if you're a conservative, you don't have that. You have a strict father family. In a strict father family, here's what happens. One, you are the authority. Your father knows best. Your job is to tell your kids what to do and your spouse what to do. You expect your spouse to support you in this, and you tell your kids what's right and what's not. And if they don't do it, then you punish them painfully enough so that they are going to avoid what feels good and just do what you tell them. That way they get disciplined to avoid what feels good and do what's right. If they can do that, they can go out in the world and become prosperous. Mm-hmm. And if they're not prosperous, they're not disciplined enough, it's their fault and they're lazy. And mm-hmm. you hear that all the time. Now, in addition to that, there's a general rule. And the rule, and by the way, you get direct causation here. Because, if the kid doesn't do what you say, you have to punish them right away so they know directly why they're being punished. Right? And the punishment is required. It's a form of love called tough love. Mm-hmm. You find Trump is always saying at the end, I love you, right? Mm-hmm. It's tough love. In addition to that, there's a general principle. It says, those who are most moral should rule. And that gives you, and how do you tell who's most moral? In a well-ordered world, by nature, look at who has ruled. Go down the list. So you have God above man, man above nature. Nature is there for you to use for your purposes. You have the rich above the poor, employers above employees, no unions. You have adults above children. In 21 states, there are paddling laws where kids can be beaten by their teachers and coaches if they're not listened to. You have things like Western culture above non-Western culture. Our country above other countries, America first. Mm-hmm. And then it gets, that's a very general conservative view. Then it gets a little bit dicier, men above women, whites above non-whites, straights above gays, Christians above non-Christians. And Trump has all of those except for straights above gays. Mm. He has gay friends. Mm. But basically, you see that in all of his policies, and you see direct causation there. You know, you don't like immigrants, build a wall. You don't like Muslims, throw them out, keep them out, don't let them in, etc. So you have direct causation in all of these things. He's saying, you know, you got a problem with China, impose a tariff. You know, direct causation on each of those things. In addition to that, you have the way that he, as a, that you have different kinds of conservatism. There's religious conservatism, which means you have a strict Father God. You know, do what I say, you go to heaven, otherwise you rot in hell. You know, well, I'll give you a second chance, but after that, that's how it works. Then you have free marketeers, mm-hmm. where the market is the strict father itself, right? So you have free market conservatives, and then you have pragmatic conservatives, and that's the largest group. Mm. These can be very poor people, all sorts of folks. They're people who want to be strict fathers in their own domain. At home, in their communities, wherever they are, at whatever economic or social scale, they have strict father morality. And they think the world should run by their, and that's how they identify themselves. Uh-huh. Those are most of Trump's supporters.
Uh-huh.
And that's who he's going for. He's not going for the free marketeers or the religious guys. And in fact, the religious guys mainly get people joining the religion because they have strict father morality. Now, Trump not only has that in spades, at all of it, the whole hierarchy, as you've seen, but he has something else. He's a super salesman. He knows how to use your brain against you. And here are some of the things he does. First, there is a phenomenon technically called salient exemplar. It means a well-known example. Okay. And all it means is this. Yeah, it started out with a discussion in the 70s by Danny Kahneman, who invented behavioral economics here at Berkeley when he was there. He pointed out there was a DC-10 that made a wrong turn at O'Hare during a storm and crashed. And then people didn't fly DC-10s after that, even though they were the safest plane.
Yeah.
The reason was very simple. When you had that crash, it was shown on TV over and over and over.
Yep.
That strengthened your brain and so on.
Yep.
And so it changed your probability, right? That well-known examples do that, like, a Latino killing somebody in San Francisco, or, a rape in Minneapolis, or a Muslim shooting people in Orlando, et cetera. And Trump uses that, and it says, this is going to make you afraid because it'll increase your improbability that this will happen to you.
Yeah.
Then he does.
Let me say one thing about this. So we were flooded in advance of the call with questions, and again today flooded with questions. And because we have to get onto the next part of the call, is it possible we could have you back where it would just be a Q&A? Because there are so many things people Absolutely. Want to know and elaborate. And this has been just remarkable, and I'm really glad that of all the people who said, please get George Lakoff on the call, that we could finally get you on, and particularly on a Saturday morning. Thank you so much. This was extremely useful. And again, if we can get you back for a Q&A, that would be, we'll get you as many of the questions in advance as we can.
And terrific. Go to georgelakoff.com, hit the blog, and go to those three understanding Trump things. And sure, we can do this again. And I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Yeah, fantastic. And you're welcome to stay on for the next 10 minutes if you like, but if you have to drop off, we'll understand that also.
It's fine, sure.
Okay, great. All right, Adeline, could you unmute the lines for David and Joel, please? And if David or Joel, if you could say something so we know that we could hear you for a second.
Yeah. Hi, guys. Okay. Hey there.
Okay, good. So just so everybody knows, Joel Bock and David Gelber were the executive producers for Years of Living Dangerously last year, the extraordinary series they put on, and are the executive producers again this year. And again, we just want to thank you for your amazing work and ask you to give us a quick minute of what should we look for this year.
Well, before, this is Joel. Before we do that, I just want to say I wish we had spent some time with George Lakoff before we put into place season
right?
two. It could be helpful to know how to appeal to this whole other set of viewers.
Yeah.
But maybe that's something we can do if we get a season three. But anyway, that was really wonderful to hear you talk, George. And, you know, hopefully we can, everyone can hear some of the responses to their questions at some point. So thank you.
Well, guys, this is David here. We really appreciate this opportunity to talk to you. We know about your work very well, I guess, because, as you know, I hope you know, one of our stories is really a profile of Jay Butera and the work that Jay's been doing. When we started thinking about season two, we thought about, you know, focusing on solutions, on what we could do about climate change and what we could energize people to push for. And you know, we were very lucky to be working with National Geographic because they were completely open to, you know, some fairly aggressive opportunities for us. I mean, we didn't want to limit it to, you know, geoengineering or screwing in new light bulbs or even putting in solar panels. We wanted to focus on the major obstacle, which is politics. Mm-hmm. And Nat Geo said, go for it. And so we've done, we had Brad Whitford, who you'll recall as Josh Wyman from West Wing, who did just a fantastic piece about Jay and about what Citizens Climate Lobby is doing. You know, it raises a lot of really interesting questions about how you talk to Republicans about this. We've also done a number of stories that deal with the whole issue of carbon pricing. And we're really kind of promoting the idea of carbon pricing as the single most necessary, if not sufficient, solution to the problem of climate change. One of our pieces is really a piece about a couple of college students who are zealots about carbon pricing, one of mm-hmm. whom attends Texas Tech University, the kind of farm team for the petroleum industry, who's just a great character. And another kid from Pomona, a student from Pomona. Yeah. So anyhow,
I think the kid from yeah. I think the kid from Texas was actually worked for CCL, if I'm not
that's
mistaken.
Right.
Is that right, David?
Yeah, I think so. He had an internship.
Yeah.
So those are yeah, go ahead, Joe.
Oh, go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, I just wanted to back up what David said is that, you know, we're such longtime fans of CCL, and you guys basically are doing, I think, really the kind of the 1-2 punch that's needed across the board, which is trying to get a carbon price in place and also trying to affect politics and affect politics in a smart way. And we have two of our, as David said, really our two big solution stories are basically what you guys do. Mm-hmm. So I think you'll really enjoy those episodes in particular. I mean, I think you'll probably enjoy the whole series, but the CCL story, I think airs in November 30th. And I understand there's a desire on your part to do some watch parties, which would be great. We would absolutely love that, to get the word out. It's Mark Reynolds is a part of the story as well. And there's, other CCL members who are in the piece. Jay ends up being kind of the main character, but a lot of you are in there. And then our carbon pricing story, which actually touches on what just happened in Canada and the work that a lot of you did up there, that's going to be the following week on December 7th. And this is all on National Geographic at 10, 9 Central.
We
can send out more information, but that's...
Yeah, no, we'll have all our details to people. I think the one on Jay Butera is actually the December 7th one, but we'll be hosting all kinds of watching parties. And I think the people you're talking to on this call probably watched most, if not all, the series last year and are really looking forward to it. And we're all pretty blown away that the two of you could make yourself this close to release of everything, that you could make yourself available on a Saturday this close to release. So thank you so much for the work, and thanks for jumping on the call, guys. And we really, really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Oh, for sure.
Great.
Again, what you guys do is just incredible work. We're so excited to profile what you do, to be aligned with you, you know, to team up on this, on any effort to get carbon pricing into the general consciousness of this country, because I just think not enough people even know about it.
Yeah.
And if they knew about it, then, you know, they would see what an elegant and perfect solution it is to climate change. So hopefully we can really spread the word of what you're doing.
Yeah, we're going to get...
And that means reaching Democrats as well as... Republicans on the issue of carbon pricing, because so far, you know, the neither candidate for president is addressing carbon pricing openly.
Great. Okay. Again, thanks again, guys. We're actually going to get an update on Canada right now. Kathy Orlando.
Okay, sounds great.
Yeah, the mute button on your line, so you could come on for a second.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thanks so much, guys. Kathy. So congratulations about the incredible announcement from Mr. Trudeau. Can you tell us a little bit about the details?
Okay, on Monday, October 3rd, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced Canada will establish a floor price on carbon pollution of $10 a ton in 2018, rising to $50 a ton by 2022. Provinces and territories will have flexibility in deciding how they can implement the carbon pricing. They can either put a direct price on carbon pollution or do cap and trade. The Government of Canada will provide pricing system for provinces and territories that do not adopt one of the two systems by 2018. This is awesome. The federal price will be revenue neutral, and it will be returned to provinces to use as they see fit.
Okay, good. Kathy, we're going to skip a couple of things because we know that you all had a lot to do with this. We also know because of the nature of your government that the president saying this means we're pretty close to this being a done deal. The last thing that I want to say is, you know, Kathy's been doing essentially my job as a volunteer for 5 years. And the extraordinary leadership that you and everybody in Canada did to put this together is remarkable. And thank you so much for that incredible work.
Thank you, Mark. And I'm humbled by you saying that. Anyways, especially thanks to Marshall Saunders, our founder and president, for his vision, his grace, and his unconditional giving, for that has been the sugar that has attracted all these wonderful people in the CCL collective that are doing this life-giving work. We would not be here without him. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah, and congratulations, Marshall. Everybody in Canada. Congratulations. What remarkable, extraordinary work. Okay, a couple quick things. So you have your actions on the sheet for Canada and U.S., and everything's laid out. Your group leaders have been briefed, so they can go over everything that we're going to be doing this month. There's a lot of action we're going to be taking, and, you know, both organizations working on editorial board meetings and meetings with members, etc. So good on all that. I do want to mention also that our Houston chapter was featured on the front page of the Houston Chronicle. That was really big, really good work. Great picture of Peter Brin there. So congratulations, everybody down there in Houston. Our CCL Edison group got 200 constituent forms on one day, which we think might be a world record. So 212 means with every copy of that going to a member of the House, and with one going to each member of the Senate, that means 636 constituent forms going to their members of the House and Senate. That is really, really remarkable work. Congratulations. And then last thing is, this is a historic, important week. You know, the fact of what happened with Paris is remarkable. And I think everybody should take a moment and celebrate that. One of the things we'll be doing on Monday is releasing a new op-ed because everybody on this call is crystal clear that we will not achieve any of those goals without an effective, transparent price on carbon. So we'll be releasing a new op-ed that'll be coming out to you. We'd like to get that to all your newspapers so that we can dovetail on top of what happened in Paris. Okay, then the last thing today is... Adeline, if you could unmute everybody's lines, I think we'd all just like to give a big old shout out to Canada and a thank you.
Thank you.
Canada.
Home and native land.
Oh, my God.